You're listening to the Barry Egan Tapes on News Talk. I'm Barry Egan from the Sunday Independent. I'm talking with Dylan McGrath. Dylan, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Barry.
Look, I'm curious, as one of Ireland's great chefs, what did you grow up eating in West Belfast?
My diet was pretty poor. I think the food that we had as children was very much about what mum could provide. So our choices as a family would have been very restricted based on the fact that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of money, you know. You know, spaghetti bolognese was a big deal. So it's a big thing in West Belfast, that sort of, you know, mum does spaghetti bolognese, you know.
Beats a lot.
Yeah. A lot of the time it was convenient food, you know. I think I lived on dry bread, mandarin oranges, and dry bread through choice, you know, because I didn't like butter as a child, and sausage, beans and chips till I was about 16. You know, there was no emphasis on, you know, artichokes or fennel or, you know, eating well and nutrition, and it just wasn't there, you know. I remember the first time there was a supermarket in Andersonstown called Curly's. It was a big supermarket, and I remember the first time I seen a kiwi fruit, you know.
What did you think it was?
This, an apple that had deteriorated, you know, a hairy apple. But I remember physically, you know, what is that? And the curiosity of that. But nutrition and stable diet was not on the important list in our house.
Joking aside, what was it like to grow up in a house where there wasn't a lot of money?
Well, you know, it's like Billy Connolly says, growing up in the tenement flats in Glasgow, you've nothing to compare it to. So there's no real awareness of that. I remember feeling a frustration as a young person that whenever I asked for money and small amounts of money to, say, go and see my friends in a different part of the city or go into the cinema in the centre of the town or to do something as you're going from a child into a teenager, there wasn't a lot there. It was a big deal, you know, to be asking for that. That was just the way our house was, you know. It wasn't a lot of disposable income, and to be given £2 or £3 at the time to go into the town or to get a bus or to get a black taxi, as it were. I suppose you create an awareness of, you know, there was another life or there was other people who didn't have the struggles that were our reality. You know?
When you went into the city, you saw people who had a few quid and you didn't?
Well, no. I mean, Belfast was Belfast, you know. You were surrounded by a tough environment, you know. And people were tough. People were brilliant as well, but they were tough, and reality was tough. But again, as a child, you don't have anything to compare it to. So you can look back now and see that. But then it's life.
Did you see things as a young man that maybe a young man shouldn't have seen? Like violence and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, lots of it. There was a constant awareness of it. But very little... There wasn't a lot of fear for it. You know, it's not... I remember a curfew being out where any Catholics... It was common knowledge that any Catholics out after 9:30 would be shot. I think it was shortly after the Schenkel bomb. And I remember being in Dublin at the time and reading as a youngster, as a teenager, all the press down here about this curfew and about this, what had happened. And, you know, because the press was huge on it. And I remember it was like an environment of like picking up the paper down here and picking up the paper in the north. It was two different things. People were just getting on with their lives in the north. I remember being fearful because of the impact of the media on this stuff, going back into that environment. And then realising that everybody was just getting on with it and nobody was going to get out. Nobody was going to get caught at around 10 on the roundabout. And you know what I mean? It was the way it was, you know, so.
And did your mother ever give you advice, you know, be careful who you talk to or any of that kind of
stuff? Oh, God, yeah, no, there would have been constant. My mother was from Kildare, you know, so she was from the Curra. So she was raised in a different time of tame army environment and then into West Belfast. So it was as much a shock, I'd say more of a shock for her, go from that into a war zone. Because let's be honest, it was. It might have been guerrilla warfare, but it was still tit for tat. Where on a daily basis, different people were getting killed. People were getting shot in their homes. We had a lot of friends in the family. My mum was quite religious, so we sort of ended up with friends in the family who maybe had ended up in prayer meetings and these different things that my mum would have attended because of the troubles and how the violence had maybe directly affected certain women whose husbands might have been shot or whose brothers had been, you know, maybe taken away for a couple of days. And horrendous things, you know, bombs going off regularly as a kid, and that was.
How did it affect you?
Like I say, you know, it's life. It's the way, you know. You get up in the morning as a British soldier, and I haven't thought about this stuff in years, to be honest. But if there's a British soldier sort of in the, you know, the porch, hunched down, a rifle, proper Rambo rifle. helmet on, bulletproof jackets, all that stuff, and that would be going to school as a kid.
And you knew that wasn't.
You'd
a
step
toy.
Over him, like you might be a little bit awkward because he's in your porch, but there'd be a little moment of passing him by and going on to school, you know. But he's the one that's under serious stress. He's the one that you know, he might have 8 or 9 of his colleagues in the street, and they're all in porches, and they might be just there to pick up a driving ticket.
And did you know men who were given punishment beatings?
Did I know men who were given punishment beatings? God, you're asking me to crack under questioning. What do you think you have here, Barry? I would say that, yeah, for sure, I knew people who were heavily involved in the Troubles. I was raised and surrounded by it as a child. People who were in leadership roles, people who were in... you know, much more lower level down, active. I mean, even joyriding was like a international sport where I was from, you know, stealing cars and sniffing glue and jumping in the, when I think about it now, you know, it was common practice. And God love my mother as well. She tried so hard to hold us close, you know. This was pretty scary stuff for her as well, that her son might end up, you know, glue sniffing and jumping into it. Because that was, you imagine, like when I look back now, you know, it's like anything. It's like a coping strategy for youngsters, you know, who have fear in their lives and who could get shot at any point, you know, by their own for doing these crazy, you know what I mean, adolescent games. The communities would deal with this stuff, not the police. There is no police force. There is nobody going to catch you. And, you know, if the police, I remember a few times the police or the army getting their hands on joyriders and stuff like that. And you would have seen it in the press how it was dealt with.
And when you went to London and you were working in restaurants over there, did you have a bit of a chip on your shoulder about being Irish in England?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So, you know, I went to school in CBS on the Glen Road, and it's all boys school, crazy, you know, when looking back now, just, you know, the reality of going to school and the types of kids that you grew up with, and you know, there was some pretty damaged kids there too, do you know what I mean? And you just were constantly on alert, constantly on your guard, constantly aware. And you lived, that was school for me, and everyone, I suppose. But when I think of the teachers, you know, like you wouldn't have been allowed to play soccer because it was an English game, and that would have been completely acceptable to have that. When Thatcher resigned, I remember the reaction with all the teachers running around the classrooms, and so, you know, everywhere I went, you know, it's like religion, you know, it's like as a child, everybody's telling you that there's a Jesus and there's a, you know, God and there's all these things. And when everybody in your early environment has this mode or mindset, it's very hard for you to shake that off and to look outside the box and say, you know, is this for real? Is this, do they really resent and hate me and want to destroy us as much as the common mentality, which was West Belfast and what they were and what we were. And, you know, the community was at war with a different country. I often think that without, and, you know, I don't want to get crazy political, but You know, I often think if there wasn't our relationship with America, what would have been Britain's reaction to this small country like Palestine and Israel? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what would have been, you know, and what our lives have been like then?
So what was it like for you suddenly to be in London working over there?
So I came first to Dublin. I had to make up my mind whether this cooking thing was going to be for me, and whether or not I could function at the topper end of it before I took a brave step like London, and did that. Worked in sort of the best places I could get into here in Dublin. A friend of mine who I'd met in a one-star Michelin restaurant, the first one-star Michelin restaurant in Belfast was called Roscoff's, and it was Paul Rankin. And it was at the end of Sandy Row. I remember even getting a job in there and being so fearful. This is reality. This is the way it was, you know. Being very watching my back and being aware and what was going to happen to me in this, you know, this, you know, because you're at the end of a road which is quite dangerous for you as a person just because of the fact that you've raised in a community that's Catholic. Whether you believe in God or how you feel about Mary or any of those things is not really, you know, you're instantly labelled as you're this colour. So you have to then function into that. And my attitude from that point was head down, anybody says anything, go for them, you know. And that would have remained like that through to London, where I would have felt the same, you know. I remember the first time a chef called me Paddy. And my reaction to that, you know.
But how long before you realised that the English didn't really care what was going on in the north?
And they really didn't, you know. I met some great English people, some great English chefs, friends, marvellous people. You know, that was it. You know, I remember dawning on me very quickly, these people have no clue. And neither do they care in the slightest what's going on in West Belfast. And that's really, that's an important thing to learn as a young guy as well, you know, that you can be suspended in a logic and in a thinking that is not necessarily correct. You could be surrounded by everybody having an opinion. Step outside that and form your own opinion, which is crucial in growing up.
Did you apply that to your life in terms of your work and your
continually,
food,
continually,
everything?
Continually. You've got to look at it and make up your own mind. Can you think for yourself? Or are you a lemming? Are you going to just walk off the cliff because everybody else is walking off the cliff?
Where did you get that from, that philosophy?
Not sure. Probably an air of arrogance in that.
Where did the arrogance come from?
I don't know. I mean, just, you know, I think it's important. I think when you're... You can be aware that you're just maybe, it's important to think for yourself. I don't know where that came from.
Where did the desire to cook the way you do? I mean, you're raised on spag bol and fish and chips and egg and chips and sausage and chips.
Okay, so I think of determination and sort of a refusal to accept things how they are, and that life can deal you a hand and you are completely entitled to throw back your cards and see what else you can get. Not sure where that came from.
Because 99% of the people on the planet accept the cards they're given. You didn't.
No, and I think that people, there is a probably underlying, if I'm honest, you know, some air of self-belief and arrogance that's necessary in order to remove yourself, believe in yourself, and go off in a different direction. And baby step maybe to begin with, but always checking the compass that you're correct and that you're right and that you might have an... So once I realised there was talent in me as a cook, it could have been anything, really. You know, it was this was the thing that I felt like, okay.
Wasn't your mum a bit worried about you going into this?
Yes, for sure. She was. Just because she'd worked in Dublin, she part-time waitressed in the Gresham years ago, and she'd looked at the little commies and the hotels and the way they'd been treated, and she said, I don't want that for you. And I says, well, I don't want this for me. So it couldn't be much worse than this, but you know what I mean? Because I'm effectively living out her choices, you know, that she's felt, right, okay, I'm going to, you know, move us up here and we're going to take this, you know, because she's just trying to do well like anyone, you know, with what she's got.
Yeah.
So, for me it was like, well, I'm not staying here and I'm not doing this, so I'm going to go.
When did you first realise that you understood food and you were creative? And
it's funny. It took me a while to focus, and I was one of these kids that I never understood it and I kind of resented it, but the teachers used to always say, you know, has it but won't use it, that sort of slogan. I had that riddled on my forehead by the time I got up to any sort of teenage years. And I remember all the other me mates laughing at me. You want to be a what? You want to be a chef? You out of your mind? I'm going to be a solicitor and I'm going to be a, you want to be a chef? So I remember kind of having to defend that. My granddad was a chef. and he was, you know, he was a chef in the army in the Curragh.
Is that where it came from?
He was cool and I liked him a lot. And he died when I was around 7 or 8. And he left me a bar of gold. Well, I used to think it was a bar of gold. It was a bar of brass. And he had convinced me that he was going to leave this for me when he died. And I found it in my nanny's and underneath the chicken shit, if I can say that, in the chicken coop. So we had this little special bond and relationship. I used to get his whiskey from the kitchen and sneak it up to him in the living room. And so he was cool. Once I started getting up a little bit, and I don't know how cooking started, but I was like making cakes, or I would have done a barbecue. I built a barbecue one time. And
did you cook from your mother
cooked,
a lot?
Cooked. Yeah, I would have tried it, you know, but I wouldn't say a lot. I went into catering college, and I would have had a difficult enough time until I focused with any authority. That was the way I was. If you were in charge, I would have tested that for many years.
Was that because of West Belfast?
No. I just think that's inherently in me, you know. And do you know what? Be it whatever way you look at it. At the same time, once I focused myself and understood the rules of the kitchen, I became very compliant because there was a self-interest. And I would have calibrated to anyone if there was information that I needed from one to the next.
Is that the way you are to this day? And that the way you'll probably go
probably,
to your grave?
Probably even better with a bit of maturity. But as a youngster, I remember taming fairly quickly once I understood, right, I love this. I'm incredibly passionate about it. I really enjoy it. And I'm not going to stop. You know, and I'm going to keep going until I get better at it. And do you know what? There was many, many years where I didn't feel good at it. I think that's important
to
remember.
That?
Probably when I was in London as well. You know, it's a tough. When you walk into the upper talent, we'll say, of a professional, say 2-star Michelin restaurant, and you're a little guy from West Belfast who's maybe worked, you know, in a 1-star here or there in Ireland, it's chalk and cheese. It's like going and playing in the Premier Division. I think I had you see, in West Belfast as well, you had these kind of chefs who, they were like old-time soldiers, you know. They worked in the centre of the town. The centre of town was dangerous for us as Catholics. Anything could happen, you know. Your own communities were dangerous, but the centre of the town was also risky. There were certain restaurants where certain guys would work that were good and had good reputations, and I would have just been a sponge. I would have just taken in as much as I could, and I got it into my head that cooking the sauces to order and reducing them to order was the freshest way to work and the best results. And when I was in college, all the other chefs resented me because I had so much washing up because I reduced all the sauces in each pan to order that it was a good 2 hours cleaning up after me. So there was early signs that I could move really quick and that I had a talent for it.
But there's no doubt you have more than a talent for it. What's the philosophy with the new restaurant, Shelburne Social?
You know what? Shelburne Social is just somewhere I'd really like to eat. I think we as cooks very often sometimes produce food to a criteria that is judged by the hierarchy. And we as chefs are driven by that judgment. And that's great. And I've been down that road and I still love that type of cuisine. But Shelburne Social is a restaurant for customers, in my opinion. I've taken the over fussy finesse and introduced a type of food that I'm really comfortable to eat. That doesn't, you know, there's a whole section on raw food. There's a chicken wing on there.
So there's not hours of washing.
There's a brilliant burger on there.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, there's still hours of washing for everyone. Yeah, no, it's a, do you know what? There's a great,
so despite what
your mother
said,
down there,
the commie chefs have got to do all the...
Everybody has to start somewhere, don't they? I mean, there's a couple of commies in the kitchen down there, and it's not. There's a good level of senior chefs in the kitchen at the minute. Guys that have a lot of experience, so you know they're translating pretty well everything that needs to be done to those guys, and we all remember what it was like to be a commie, you know.
Yeah. Mm. And do you ever stop yourself from dreaming of the next big project, the next big thing?
I'm a lot more aware of what that pursuit is today. I'm a lot more at peace with it in me. I feel as I get older, you have to be a little bit wiser about what choices you make and what risks you take. I have a great team of people with me today, genuinely, that I'm very blessed to have. Because it needs to be a team of people, you know, to do what we're doing.
But you weren't like that when you were in Mint, and
when you're a little bit younger, I suppose you know.
How do you look back on that young man who Michelin star and very driven, very ambitious, almost obsessive about everything?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the right way to look at it is with a bit of compassion for yourself. That's one thing. I also, you couldn't have tapped me on the shoulder and told me, you know. I had to figure it out.
And if I had tapped you on the shoulder and tried to tell you, what would you have said? Get your hand off my shoulder.
You really need to ask that question. Look, it's all experience. It's all life. It's all trying to pursue improvement or getting better. The people around you getting better. That's the way I look at it. It's unfortunate. It's terrible sometimes when you're living in something that's not right and not clicking, and no matter how much you pursue or try to get it right, that it's not clicking the way you want it to, and then you have to step back and learn from that. But it's the pursuit and the journey that can be fascinating.
You're quite a philosophical person. Like, even the way you speak, it's quite poetic. Were the books you read as a child, or was your mum influencing you in a lot of ways? Does everyone in West Belfast talk like you?
You're making me blush now. I just try to pursue the truth to some degree, what's right and what's correct and what's not. But
your mum was religious. Are you?
Do you know, I started on a thing of meditation whenever I was really ill with my back. And I believe in spirituality. I always did. I think that as you get up a little bit, your idea of if there is a God changes. I think, when you're young, you have a sort of thing that's drilled into you. And then as you're older, you sort of, like most things, form your own opinion. And I think that that's something that is important, because I think that we've a body, a mind and spirit, right? So I found that was a healing part for me. With the back and severe pain.
Did it help you with the pain?
It helped me with coping with the pain, which was massive.
Because you were saying Jesus a lot, because your back's in
agony. Yeah, well, I mean, you can do medication for a while, and you know, and then you've got to get up and walk, and you've got to do physio, and you've got to calm down, and you've got to accept. And different people as well. My family were great during that time too. So, you know, it was something that we, it was something we did.
But were you worried? During that period that you wouldn't
walk?
Yeah,
no, I was worried, yeah, for sure, yeah. I was more than worried, you know. They were, you know, the doctors were telling my family that I might not walk again, you know. So that was...
It's pretty heavy stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I was fairly frustrated at the time, and just had to step back and say, you know, I came through it. Don't ask me how I came through it.
How did you come through it?
Family support, good people around me. You know, you get through it. You have to. You have a choice, right? You can look at it and say, right, I'm going to stay in this place, frustrated and angry and all that, or else I can move out of it and slowly accept things the way they are.
Are you a different person now?
Yeah, I suppose I am.
But you seem calmer and happier and more relaxed than you've ever been.
Mm. Yeah, I am. I'm way more relaxed, way more at ease with where things are. And I think that when you're in that situation where you don't know what way it's going to go, and then you'd make a decision that it's really important that you repair that and that you heal, I think that it's very crucial that you understand that that's also going to change you, I think. So,
was it a message from the universe or God, or saying, look, Dylan, stop killing yourself with too much work and too much obsession?
Well, I think that there's a point in any ambitious person's life where you have to ask yourself, is the pursuit of things going to make you happy? And do you feel any happier when you get them? Does that make sense?
Mm.
And then when you pursue things and you achieve things that maybe you felt should make you happy, that when you reflect and say, do I feel better? And if the answer is no, then maybe the answer isn't there. So part of that is something that I processed when I was ill. I mean, proper ill, you know.
Sitting on your own, thinking about where is this going to go?
Well, no, I mean, it's not, you know, if you're on your own, it's because, you know, because you're maybe not able for people. You know what I mean? When you're ill, does that make sense? But also you reflect on what's important, who's there, your family. My family just rallied around me. You know what I mean? The strength and support that I felt from them was just unbelievable, and so much more gratitude for them and grateful for them because of the fact that, you know, in my 20s, well, I mightn't have been there as much, you know what I mean? And whenever they need me, they stepped in. My relationship with my sister, my relationship with my brothers have just, like, unbelievable. And it's given me a fresh way to look at it all, you know? And I think it overall, even though it was tough, it's probably done me some good to step back and reflect and see what's important. And
what will you do for Christmas?
Spend family again.
Will you be cooking?
Yes, I'm going to cook. Some of us have some family in Carlo.
Is there 2 hours of washing up when you cook Christmas dinner?
Yeah, no, Billy's going to give me a hand.
Look at your daggers? You were saying, is there going to be reducing the sauce down?
No, we'll keep it relatively tight. We'll get some of the prep done in the restaurant, I hope. And it'll just be a case of heating up containers.
Listen, Dylan, Merry Christmas. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Barry.